I've started recording while we're already on an interesting topic, and I'm just going to go with it. Basically, we're talking about riding in Belgium, and it's very relevant, bearing in mind it's Flanders this weekend. And, you know, I think what we were just saying is that for both of us, that part of the world is an amazing place to cycle. Like, it's not easy riding. That's the only way I can describe it. Like, it's challenging. You've got such a variety of surfaces, and there's so much history with the racing. And Belgian, French, Dutch, because I'm going to kind of class that area in one segment, because, I mean, so often the races cross in between France, Belgium, or the Netherlands. They just get cycling as well, which is kind of great. It's really great.
It's less like a nice place to visit as well. Like, there's loads of... I know there's bakeries in loads of French villages, but if you come across some, like, there's some little sleepy little northern French towns that you'll suddenly, you might come off a dirt road or a bit of a cobble track into, and it's just this lovely little, you're like, they look pretty similar. There's like Belgian towns, French towns with the like red, very red brick, different to our red brick, but like a lot of them new built, like post-war, or there might be buildings that did survive that time, but they're just really distinctive looking stuff that people drive past really quickly because they get the Eurostar across and just like bomb down to the Alps, which I can get, but they miss that like lovely part of northern France and Belgium. So it's just like a nice place to ride and eat nice food and meet nice people as well.
I remember another thing, we were just talking about how the Roulet ride that Francis, Gareth Winter, myself, and a couple of people did with Johan Museo, which was like incorporating three different classics or, you know, spring early calendar races into one route. And that's how we got onto the subject anyway. But kind of tied into that, it's also several years ago, I got dared by my friend's son who goes to the Pace Center, which is the charity I do loads of stuff with. Charlie dared me to ride from my work, which was in, at the time, in like south or northwest London. He dared me to ride from my work to Paris overnight and to get there and take a photo underneath the Eiffel Tower. And he didn't think I'd be able to do it, as in get there. I can't remember what the time lane. I basically think he said to me he wanted me to do it in under 24 hours. And so I left my office. I went on my TT bike because I was like, I've got to do this as quick as I possibly can. I left my office. Six, and my mate Nick drove a car behind following so I could get back, and Francis came along and like vlogged it and basically left six, cycled from where my office was in London down to, where did I get the ferry from? I think Folkestone or something like that, New Haven. And then
nice route, or was it just a shamelessly quick direct route?
The England side was a shamelessly quick direct as possible, incorporated some gravel for fun of it, which on a TT bike is not fun. And then I didn't intentionally incorporate gravel. Anyway, and then it was from New Haven, then New Haven to, you get the ferry to Dieppe. And then from Dieppe to Paris is actually a really lovely route. And you go past all those bakeries and small towns and stuff like that. And it was like it was like 6 o'clock in the morning or something, because I did the ferry through the night and then rode in the morning, and got to this little town, and I could just smell the bakery. And I very distinctly remember it, going in there and probably spending like 30 euros on so much stuff for myself and Nick and Francis. Just went in there, bought everything. It's all warm, it's all fresh. Sat on the outside the bakery, scoffing it down, just being like, that was the best breakfast I've had in a very long time.
Delicious.
Yeah. Anyway, I should probably say who you are and what we're doing. Of course, we're recording another podcast. And I've got Luke from Outdoor Provisions, who I have a stash here behind me, you may see.
I did notice that. When we first started, I wasn't sure if you were recording or not, so I wasn't sure how much like I was supposed to mention things off script, but I did notice that. Thank you.
There's no script. There's no script. There's never a script.
I'm raging past my window.
I thought it was a dog at first, actually.
I mean, yeah, I'm quite near a road, unfortunately, where I'm sat now. But
Yeah, go on. So Outdoor Provisions make sort of I'd say like adventure bars, and also this stuff, which if you are easily addicted to nut butters, do not buy, because you will eat it by the tub. I bought these the other day. They turned up yesterday. I think I've nearly finished one. So that bodes well.
That's good. It's good for us. It's good for business.
It's good for business, definitely. It's not good for my waistline. That's the only thing. I have to put them in a cupboard.
Not the worst thing you could be addicted to, mine, but yeah, I'll give you that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that is genuinely credit to the flavors. The flavors are really lovely. I really like the almond, date and sea salt one. That's the one for me. And I think this might be the one that you did on a sandwich for me.
Yeah. That was the first time we met, wasn't it? Yeah. Made you a sandwich.
Yeah.
So yeah, the nut butters there originally started in sachet form, which is kind of we must be the only people to do it that way around, making like a single serve sachet that you take with you. Because yeah, we used to eat a lot of peanut butter, almond butter anyway. But then wanting to be able to actually take that with us on rides and runs and stuff, to be able to use its like its slow release properties. It's like generally very easy on your stomach. It's very nutrient dense. So you get nearly, in one of our little sachets, you get nearly like 200 calories of something that's slightly salty as well. So not too far on the sweet spectrum to take with you for like lower intensity activities. Mm. So yeah, we did sachets first, which was definitely the harder way around to do it. And then we went into jars from there, because people started asking for it to like have for breakfast, put on porridge, put on toast and that kind of thing. But the sachet ones, you can eat neat, or you can stick them on a banana or whatever you've got with you. We call them a utility snack because you can use them with loads of stuff. But yeah, generally I just eat them neat. It's like having a big spoonful of smooth blended.
Which is disgustingly good.
Yeah, it is actually good. Enough. It's like pocket warm as well. That's what you want, pocket or jersey pocket warmed. I don't know what the exact temperature is, but just slightly warm makes it very nice.
I know exactly what you mean, which is the worst bit.
and they're
a little bit sweaty on the outside sometimes.
Yeah, I give that. We do have a bit of an image problem because you cannot squirt nut butter onto like a banana without it looking pretty suspect. So like very high taste and deliciousness and effectivity levels, but looks pretty suspicious. So
yeah,
we've got to work on that image problem somewhere.
So there's peanut, almond and raspberry, hazelnut and cacao, coffee, almond and cashew, and the almond, date and sea salt. They're all very good. I highly recommend, especially if you have a nut butter addict. Shit, just dropped one. Put them out of the way now. Safety. And so yeah, it was the nut butters and then the bars kind of came first.
So yeah, we started Outdoor Provisions about 3 years ago. It's me and another guy, Christian, who's just had a little one, so he's not with us today, but we're both Manchester based. We met riding bikes literally at a set of traffic lights the first time somewhere in South Manchester. We both live in different parts of Manchester now, but yeah, met when we used to be, well, we've both always ridden bikes, but we're both pretty roadie at the time. Got chatting at a set of traffic lights and then proceeded to do quite a lot of riding together. Dabbled in a bit of racing. I was like wonderfully mediocre racer. Did make it to Cat 2 at the end of the year, but never actually raced in Cat 2. So yeah, like wonderfully amateur, like proper British amateur racing scene, but did used to love that. And then we got more into like gravel bikes and bike packing. Went and did some trips like Twino Nice Rally, the Belgian one I was talking to you about before, the Maltini bootleggers ride, Bike Divide and stuff, which I think we're going to cover later. And then like more latterly into mountain biking. So now we're just kind of into bikes in general. But yeah, we met through bikes basically and started Outdoor Provisions about 3 years ago, which just came at the right time when we were looking for to sort of try something a bit different with respective sort of careers in late 20s, but then particularly had this idea around how we thought we could improve energy snacks, which we thought were a bit lackluster beforehand. And yeah, it was literally on a bikepacking trip when we sort of talked it into existence. And by the end of this 4 or 5 days on a bike and sleeping in bodies and bivy bags, we'd pretty much committed to starting Outdoor Provisions.
And it's one of the things that I have always really liked is the choice of the names of the bars as well, because they very much relate to, there's a nostalgic thing, especially for me anyway, with Cherry Bakewell and Kendall Mint. There's something very nostalgic about those names. Because
they've all got like a regional link.
Yeah.
So I'm going to upset you now because we've had to change it recently to, they're all the same flavors. But so the first ones were, Cherry Bakewell, which was for the Peak District, which is like our national park because we're Manchester based. So we spend a lot of time in the Peak. I'm from Cumbria originally. So there was the Lake District linked one, which is sort of based on chocolate Kendall mint cake. And then for Yorkshire, Christian's a Yorkshireman. So if you've ever been to Yorkshire, you've probably had Parkin before. I'm pretty sure Toby from Cold Dark North might contest that and say it's from Lancashire, but I'm pretty sure it's from Yorkshire. And then Snowdonia is the Barra Brith, which is like a Welsh tea bread that you get in like cafes in Snowdonia. Or if you had like a family member from Snowdonia, they'd serve you like warm Barra Brith, which is like orangey and tea flavored. But as I was saying before, we started like that and it was lovely. And if you met someone from Snowdonia, they'd love the fact that you had a Barra Brith inspired bar. And it still says inspired by Barra Brith on the bar. But there's too many people that didn't know what Barra Brith was. So we've basically, the flavor is now tea and orange, which is a little bit more easy to understand. But the OG flavors were my favorite too.
Yeah, it's just a nice nod. And it's nice to have that little nod to the where you're from and kind of the heritage of your brand. I say heritage, 3 years is an incredibly short amount of time to kind of get to the position where you're at. But also 3 years also is weirdly quite a long time. I guess the last 3 years as well, it feels like it's been a bloody long 3 years for most people.
Yeah, we launched about 6 months before the pandemic hit. So I suppose we didn't really know enough then anyway for it to have had like a big effect on what we were doing, but it certainly did change the way we ended up operating a company. And it sort of puts into perspective the fact that we're still going now, definitely still working out what we're doing, but it could have easily been the end of it after 6 months. So glad it hasn't been.
Yeah. The thing to mention really is that for a new company to survive through the last few years that we've had is really a credit to the work that you guys are doing and also the products you're producing. Like, there's been multi-billion pound businesses that have completely failed. And you could argue part of the strength of it is the fact that, the outdoor scene and industry is actually probably one of the very few that has benefited quite well out of the pandemic. But also a lot of it goes down to the hard work that you guys have put in. And one of the things I really like is the honesty and sort of the genuine personality in the brand, that it's very honest and very kind of like friendly and welcoming, which is really probably what keeps people wanting to come back and purchase compared to some other brands out there doing maybe similar style stuff to you guys, but maybe they feel a bit more cold.
It was certainly like, it's you learn a lot of lessons when you have a go at doing your own business. And we were pretty confident we knew how to make a really good product. That's actually Christian's side of things, particularly the bars. That was his previous line of work that led him to kind of put together this like base for the bars that's really good on your stomach, all natural, vegan, no refined sugars. And then we like worked on the flavors on top of that. So it's helped to start with a really solid product, because I'd hate to have to build a brand around a product you didn't really believe in.
Yeah.
But then there are plenty of other sort of snack makers out there, if you know what I mean. And that includes like Mars bars, completely different kettle of fish, but there's also plenty of energy snack makers. So you've really got to work out where you're going to stand out and where you're going to sit, kind of what your niche is. And as you've sort of touched on there, we're like less of a harder, faster, stronger performance brand. You can use our stuff to put in a performance. Like, they've been used for rowing across the Atlantic. They've been used for Pennine Way attempts, FKTs actually. But generally, as a brand, we talk about it's just people that want to spend time outdoors or choose to spend time practicing their favorite outdoor pursuits and need like a portable energy snack to go with that. So that's where we're trying to sit ourselves, which is sort of what you were touching on then.
And I think, as I just sort of touched on as well previously, how we met was you made me a sandwich. And
yes,
this, I have to bring this up because I bring this up to quite a lot of people. This was probably one of the best sandwiches I've ever had, period. Like,
yeah, it's going to sound terrible when you explain it, but I had one as well, and they were pretty good. Go on,
basically, I believe it was almond, date, and sea salt nut butter. I believe.
Yeah, I think at the time we only had that one and the coffee one out. The other two have been a recent addition.
Yeah, and it was, the bread was like a lovely sourdough loaf that I think you'd bought tons of it and were kind of running out of it quite quickly.
Not made by us. That was, I think, Service Course provided that actually, because it was on their gravel bonanza ride, wasn't it? Somewhere in the week.
It was good bread. It was good quality bread. Then it was cheese and apple.
Yeah, thinly sliced by myself. Can't remember what the cheese was. And then, big dollop of nut butter on top, which was slightly salty.
Squirting it, brew.
Oh, yeah, we had squirty tubes, didn't we? Yeah, that's like when we do feed stops, you get nut butter in a squirty tube because it's so good on various things, like on top of a banana, straight in someone's mouth, in a sandwich.
Yeah.
Need to add that to the list. Porridge, it's really good in porridge as well. I'm just glad it was a good sandwich, or we might not have made it this far. You may never have spoken to us again.
I very much remember that sandwich. And just thinking that it was a weird thing, that it was a combination of flavors that worked incredibly well. But it, as you said, when you say it out loud, it doesn't make sense, but it really does work. And
I like feed stops because, it's nice meeting people. Like, I've been to loads of events with feed stops, and like good ones and bad ones, kind of like the bad ones just being loads of sweets. The token chopped up banana. But we've been, so we didn't get to do many events in the first couple of years because of COVID, but now they've started creeping back. It's quite nice to do a kind of outdoor provisions style feed stop where we can like up the expectations of the feed stop a bit and have the nut butters and squeezy tubes and stuff to put them on. And then we've got the bars as well. I think people want more savory stuff at feed stops than they're usually offered as well.
Yeah, I agree, because quite often, you know, there's obviously so much science in the benefits of fueling with carbohydrates, and carbohydrates generally are salty. No, that's wrong. Carbohydrates are generally sugary. There's a lot of science in that, and everyone understands that. But it is also, I'm a big believer in palate cleansing, which means having something that's more salty, whether that is, and especially for some of the longer stuff I've done, that could be. I was watching something the other day, and when I did the 91 reps up and down Box Hill, because I was trying to, my mate filmed it in his vlog, and I was trying to like remind myself what it was like for some stuff I'm planning to do later this year. And at one point I stopped, like towards the end of it, I think I had 10 reps to go, and I'm standing there eating a tomato and mozzarella pasta dish, and I'm talking absolute gibberish because I'm shattered. I've been up for 26 hours. I'm absolutely shattered, and I remember it because it was perfect, because it was salty, and I'm going about umami flavoring and stuff, because tomatoes is an umami flavor, like cheeses and everything. And my mates are just like, what the fuck are you talking about? You're talking rubbish. But no, it's legit. Tomatoes are salted. Where I'm going is that it's, you know, especially I think for endurance stuff, being able to mix that up from continually having sweet stuff by going for something savory, I think is incredibly important, because it just cleanses your palate, allows you to get stuff down, which maybe you haven't been able to get down. You get to a point where you get almost like flavor fatigue with lots of sweet stuff, in my opinion anyway. So stuff that's unflavored is quite good to keep getting calories in, but also changing it to stuff which is savory, be nut butters or whatever, I think is a really great way to fuel for long distance stuff anyway, from my experience.
Yeah, I get it from towards the end of a longer day, crave the salty stuff more. Because you've lost salts as well, as some of the other reason, but definitely time and a place for sweet stuff. And like, I love bag of Haribo every so often. But yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And how, now this is, I didn't sort of brief about this, but I am genuinely curious. How the hell do you make like a nut butter?
So yeah, it's tree. Well, they're all tree nuts. So like, actually, the easiest way to explain to people or reference people is peanut butter was actually only one of them with peanuts in the peanut almond and raspberry one, the one that's like that mad red color because it's just natural raspberry. It's literally dried raspberry in there, so it's quite tart. So it's all blended tree nuts. They've got a little bit of coconut oil in as well. Varying levels of salt in there. So it's as recipes go, you can look at the ingredients list, they're all pretty small.
Mm.
And then it's natural flavorings on top. So the coffee, are you holding the coffee one there? I can't see, but the coffee one's got some, it's the raspberry one. So yeah, that literally just has raspberry in it. Then the coffee one has finely ground Red Bank coffee in. So it's got trace caffeine in. It's fairly subtly coffee though. Like if you like coffee, it's definitely the one to go for. But even if you don't, it's very like subtly coffee. We've got non-refined date syrup in the date and sea salt one. And then the hazelnut and cacao one is like kind of, I probably shouldn't say this. Don't tell Ferrero or whoever it is that makes Nutella this, but it's definitely inspired by Nutella. It's like a more wholesome version of Nutella, like without all the palm oil and all the preservatives and stuff. So yeah, it won't be that like spready texture you expect from Nutella, but it's like got that like really addictive sort of chocolatey hazelnutty taste. Like, that's the one for on porridge. That one is really good.
This one on porridge. Okay, I have porridge almost every day, so I'll do that tomorrow.
Nice.
What? And everything is made in Manchester.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't answer your question then. No, so we have some what they were blended in the UK somewhere in Shropshire. So they blend them and then send them to us in tubs. And we have the machine in our office in Manchester, which helps us put them in sachets. So it's quite a hands-on process. And sometimes we add flavorings ourselves as well. So we've got some like big blenders and stuff. It's very, very sort of startup at the moment. Christian must have hand sealed an ungodly amount of sachets because the machine is very much his baby. So we need to sort of like move production on at some point, but because it's not often done, they're not often put in sachets in the UK. It's more of an American thing where they have like sachet nut butters. Because they do, you know, they do a lot of like through hiking long trails in America. Like there's the Appalachian Trail and Pacific Crest stuff. Pacific Crest, is it called? PCT, yeah.
It sounded right, so we'll go with it.
Yeah, so they use a lot of like very nutrient dense, but as low a weight as you can get. Like they're often carrying jars of peanut butter with them. And then sachets of it are popular in America as well. So if you go into like an REI or something, an REI store, you'd get a lot more choice. But in the UK, there's only a handful of people doing it. And then the thing, this would be a good time for me to mention. So we have made single servings of this, which you would argue is more packaging, which we do was a big concern for us when we started, like more single-use packaging. So probably the other big distinction from Outdoor Provisions and 99% of other brands is all of our packaging is, so the sachets and the bars, this is home compostable. So it's cellulose based. So it's packaging we developed ourselves. It's like one of the biggest headaches of getting the company off the ground actually was getting this packaging to work and seal. So when you've eaten your bar, bring it home, get it in your food waste bin. It's like green or brown, depending on where you are. Or if you're into composting, into your well-maintained compost patch and it'll break down in there, the other stuff. So that's like no plastic packaging into landfill. Which for brands that play on in the like outdoors market, you know, a lot of energy snack brands are for outdoor enthusiasts, to have a product that's single use and wrapped in plastic, so it's just more plastic to landfill, just didn't really make, there was a bit of a disconnect with that at the start for us. So that was kind of one of the fundamentals of getting Outdoor Provisions off the ground, and we've sort of ever since stayed pretty fiercely low impact.
It's great. And the thing is, when you look at the packaging, that I always think quite often with the kind of like this stuff that is compostable, always feels a bit weird, but that's kind of, it's actually quite nice because then you know that it's compostable because of the feeling of it and the texture of it.
Yeah, I suppose like the problems with it are endearing. So, like, it causes us no end of headaches that all every machine ever made to like pack an energy bar or pack a nut butter sachet or sachet of anything is designed to be used with plastic. So they can guarantee that it like seals at the, this is super like niche energy snack chat bell, so I'll skip on soon, but like they're designed to seal that kind of plastic to guarantee that kind of plastic lasts for like ages and ages. Ours is good and does most of those things. But it's presented problems, like it doesn't seal in quite the same way and it can break down differently when you're using it and stuff. So we like the fact that we have these problems because it knows we're trying to change things. But if a few bigger companies got on board with this kind of like compostable packaging, suddenly all the machine manufacturers would be like, well, we'll adapt the machines to this and that. And it would just be like a snowball effect of like people moving in the right direction. Like, I'm not even 100% sure that compostable packaging is the right way, but at least we're trying to do something to change the situation. It's just this temptation for everyone to stay, oh, we just use plastic because the machines all work on it and we know it lasts this long. Whereas it needs a bit of a like movement from the bottom up really to get more people on board. So I hope we're going to pave the way for people doing it more.
I completely agree. I really do. And like, I've got a dog and he's upstairs, thankfully, because otherwise he'd be pestering us. I insist on buying compostable, I have some in my hand, compostable dog food bags because, always in your pocket, always at hand somewhere, because that to me is like, geez, like that is such a waste otherwise. Dog shits like 3 times a day. You know, you go through these like anything, the least you can do is use a compostable bag where you can put it in your garden waste or whatever. And I think pretty much every house will have some sort of compostable bin or bucket or whatever it is now, because I remember when I was a kid, that wasn't a thing, having a recycling bin. It just had one bin, but it's getting better and better.
Yeah, it definitely relies on it. We're going miles away from cycling chat, aren't we here? But it definitely relies on like, infrastructure as well. So you've got to be, because a lot of people don't compost, so if you end up putting one of our wrappers in your regular bin, then it's not going to break down at anywhere near the same length and it will end up in landfill. So it does rely on like the systems being in place, but again, it's just doing the best we can with what's available.
Yeah, completely agree. We'll go back to cycling.
You're going to be losing listeners left, right and centre here.
No, I don't think so. I mean, for me, like that side of it is personally, I think, is way more interesting than the cycling side, because it's knowing about, you know, the history of the brand and why you have created it and what your kind of ethos is. And that's really important. And I think a lot of people will praise you for, you know, sticking pretty solid to those kind of rules, you know, making everything locally, making stuff that's compostable and making stuff that just tastes really good. Like it's like triple win. I don't know if it is a triple win, but it sounds like a triple win to me.
Hey, some that are pretty succinctly there, better than I could have done.
There's two specific routes I want to cover. And I know you're very keen to cover, especially Second City Divide. And then there's obviously the Badger Divide as well. So what is Second City Divide to start with? And what is the Badger Divide?
Sure. So when I mentioned before that the Outdoor Provisions was born on a bike backing trip, it was on specifically the beta edition of what we refer to as the Second City Divide, which is a bike packing route that Christian and I spent quite a lot of time developing just as a bit of a passion project, really. It was born out of riding things. I'll cover Badger Divide in a second. But it was born out of riding things like Trina Nice Rally, which are big, like A to B, point to point, multi-day bikepacking trips over like rough stuff, gravel, tarmac, a bit of everything. Mm. And we wanted to basically do one that was more on our doorstep. As soon as we came back from doing Torino Nice, we were like, well, we know there's some quite nice bits north of Manchester. We know a nice way into Manchester. And then I was like, I know there's some nice bits in the Pennines. And then by the map, we'd sort of seen some bits in Scotland that we'd already ridden before. And before we knew it, we were like, well, Glasgow to Manchester makes sense. And then the name Second City Divide was pretty much me getting carried away with the route naming convention and everything being called a divide. I think technically it's supposed to be a watershed, a divide, you know, like a where any rainfall falls one way or another, but actually it roughly traces the Pennines once it gets out of Scotland, so it's not totally incorrect to call it a divide. You could just argue as to whether Birmingham was the second city or Manchester was the second city, but like from Manchester, so went for the Manchester thing. I like to wind up people in Birmingham. So this route was born over like three or four years of refining and recceing. So that means a lot of like taking bits out that were either turned out not to have the right kind of access, or were maybe a bit unnecessary or too rough or too boring or whatever. The first version of it was way too long, and now we're down to about 600K, and I think it's about perfect. That first running the beta edition in 2018 was way more than that. But that's when we first like talked Outdoor Provisions into existence. And now it's just sort of sitting there for people to ride whenever they want, really.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. And I mean, it's, you know, the route itself will be stunning. You think about where it's going and where it's coming through. I've not done it. It's on my list. We've sort of talked about me doing it at some point as well. And you're doing an edition as well, aren't you, in September? Is that right?
So yeah, so in the grand scheme of things, not many people have done it. Have been, I couldn't even put a number on it, but we do a mass finish event instead of a mass start event, because, you know, when you do a big ride, like a bikepacking trip or something, and it's cool setting off together, but it can sometimes be a bit of a buzzkill if you finish at the end. And so like when we finished Torino Nice, you're supposed to finish at Café de Cycliste in Nice, and we got there and it was closed, or it was just closing, and it was like, oh, I mean, I think we picked up anyway. We went and found a beer somewhere, but you were like, oh, this is a bit of a shame. So the idea of a mass finish in Manchester, and because we're in Manchester as well, we can like host a bit of a do with beer and pizza and stuff. And it's a bit of a steeplechase almost. So you can choose when you set off. If you think it's going to take you 6 days, you set off then. If you think it's going to take you 3 days, you're kind of like merged together at the end and finish within a kind of window of about an afternoon, basically a Sunday afternoon. So yeah, mass finish event on September the 4th, which is a Sunday.
That's great.
But you can ride any, like people ride it any time of year. So people have done it in November, in May, any time over summer, really.
Oh, it'd be amazing in the summer. Well, September, the weather generally is pretty good, but you know, in the summertime, it'd be an incredible route to do. And there's loads of information about it on secondcitydivide.cc.
Yeah. Always wanted a website with .cc on the ends. Yeah. A little bit more about it then. So it does go through some lovely spots. You've got like the Scottish borders, which I could spend ages in. In fact, it was hard not to just like go and do loads of nice roads in the border. So we've kept it fairly like streamlined through the border so you can make progress. But I think it's probably some of my favorite riding through there. It takes you like down across to Kielder, which is like dirty river territory. Mm-hmm. Lots of long gravel roads there. And you eventually cross over Hadrian's Wall and into the North Pennines. And you've got some pretty lumpy stuff there, getting over Cross Fell. You get views across to sort of the Lake District. You come down through Eden Valley and then you're into Yorkshire. Like there's so much variation on this ride. Like you'd never get bored of it, but it is hard. It's pretty stabby. You're up to Tanhill in Yorkshire and all the lovely Dales stuff. And down towards Ribblehead. I've skipped over some bits there. There's definitely some really punchy climbs in between there and Ribblehead. And then from Ribblehead, it kind of veers off towards Lancashire to do Salterfell Road, where you then get views of the sea. Mm. And then it kind of comes back round through lumpy Lancashire onto bits of the Pennine Bridleway, the not too rough bits. And then like that's when you start to catch glimpses of Manchester for the first time. And then you skirt around Manchester and in on these roads that we've sort of ridden a lot.
I love the Pennine Bridleway as well. It's just
fun. Yeah, bits of it are, on a gravel bike, bits of it are a bit rough and there's a lot of gate opening. Ours is a bit more directly, sort of takes the bits that are good of it and then misses the bits that are a bit more protracted and kind of cuts you down towards Manchester. Have you done that Rooley Moor Road bit above the long cobbled, well, it's a descent the way we do it, but do you know the bit I mean?
I think so, yeah. I don't think I've done it, but I think I know what you mean, yeah.
If you end up coming on Second City, you'll see it, but that's like the first time you see Manchester and that's pretty special.
Nice, that's cool. There's one thing I've noticed since I moved up to the Peak District is it is a cyclist's playground. Like, there's just, whether you want to go mountain bike, road, gravel, or, you know, whatever floats your boat, there is so many options for what you want to do. Admittedly, it's quite a lot of punchy climbing, but there are ways of getting around that. Like, you could get onto one of my favorite bits around here is the Tissington Trail. And like, for me, how I would do it, it means I go up Thorncliffe Bank, which is a dickhead of a hill. From my front door to the top of Thorncliffe is about 20 minutes to half an hour of climbing. And then you're at the top, and then do some little switchbacks, sort of heading towards this random bit where I join onto the Tissington Trail. And from that point where I join on, it's 35 kilometers downhill. And it's great. Yeah, it's amazing. Gravel, like, nice, pretty, you could do it. I've done it on a road bike. It's fine on the road bike, but nice gravel, 35K of it, slightly downhill. You know, it's an old train line, so it's completely, you know, exposed on both sides, which is quite cool. And you're slightly raised up from the fields, and then you go through the woods and stuff. And as you're going along it, some of the old stations have been turned into cafes, so you can stop, get a coffee or whatever. It's great. And it's nice because you see people out there with their families, you know, kids and parents going up and down it, dog walkers, you know, it's really just, I enjoy that bit of riding. And that's one of the things I found about here is that I think especially people who are definitely London based, which is where I lived for 12 years, are maybe slightly pigeonholed into what they think good riding is in the UK. And then they go somewhere like Peak District, Lake District, you know, Kilda Forest, for example, and it just blows people's minds. It really does, because there is incredible cycling in the UK, and there's less asshole drivers up north.
There's a lot of variety, isn't there? That's the thing as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that bit that you're in, so you're in the South Peak, aren't you, which is like the White Peak, we can get down to as well. It's like a big day out from us, because we're in the northern bit of the peak, which is like the gritstone is the dark peak, and then you're the White Peak, which is limestone. It's squint on a sunny day where you are, and it looks like Strada Bianchi, some of those roads. You have to squint pretty hard, but
yeah.
on a like a lovely dusty sunny day, I would use, like, you'd use Tissington Trail, and what's the other trail down there? There's another not the High Peak Trail, south of Buxton, anyway.
Yeah,
you can use them to like link up lots of nice gravel roads around there. It's a bit rougher where in the bit that we're in, but yeah, I do love the Peak District. I've got a big soft spot for it.
Yeah.
And then that transfers into the whole Second City Divide route, that over 600K you will do back roads, tarmacked back roads, potholed back roads, fine gravel roads, forestry roads, lumpy bridleway, byways, permissive ways, farm tracks, cart tracks, like literally cart slab tracks in the Lancashire bit. It's just because there's parts of the world where you could do 600K and it would look pretty samey.
Yeah.
So you've got the variety of riding on Second City Divide that's great. And then variety of like accents change in 600K. You've got like Geordie accents over by Kielder, like thick Glaswegian as you leave there, softer borders. And then you'll notice like Lancashire and Yorkshire all the way through. What food they're serving in the cafes changes. So you've got like Lawn Square sausage at the Glen Cafe outside St Mary's Lock, which if you do Second City Divide, you must try and stop there, not least because there's nothing for like the next 100K. Then you get into Cumbria and you've got like Cumberland sausage sandwiches going, Eccles cakes when you get towards Manchester. Like, there's just so much variety in the UK for riding. You're not going to get bored, which helps on a long ride like that, because it's definitely hard riding. So the fact you've got all this changing scenery, it kind of keeps the flow going.
I completely agree. One of the things about it, what would you recommend as a bike choice for it? Would you go gravel bike or mountain bike or cross bike, or was it kind of work for any of them?
Yeah, $1 million question, because there's definitely no like perfect bike for it, but it was definitely when we were putting it together, it was when we were first getting into like wider tired, higher volume tired bikes. Notice me trying not to call them gravel bikes, but they are gravel bikes. But now the lines are blurred with kind of hardtails or big 29er kind of gravel bikes. Something that can handle the rougher end of stuff would help on Second City Divide, because it's not going to slow you up drastically on the smoother bits, but you need something that's capable for the rougher stuff, like parts of the Pennines, parts of Yorkshire. Most of Scotland is quite smooth going, but you want like something that can take a tire size, like minimum 35C, which most of those kind of bikes have now. Something like a 42 would be really nice. And obviously you're going to ride it fully loaded. I mean, you could credit card tour Second City Divide if you wanted, and go to loads of nice B&Bs and that kind of thing. But I think it's so well set for taking your camping stuff with you and trying a bit of wild camping. There's bodies in Scotland. There's body on Crossfell, Greg's Hut. Mm-hmm. And there's YHAs and there's wild camp spots. So if you're looking for like a UK trip to maybe like dip your toe in if you've not done multi-day stuff, or maybe like do a big kit shakedown for a European trip you've got planned or something, that'd be the way I'd try and do it. It's like a mix of a couple of nights in a YHA and then a couple of nights wild camping or bodying or something. Oh, and the point, your bike's got to be able to carry all your stuff is what I was going to say. Sorry, what's going on?
I think it's really important. Like I get asked quite a lot how to get into bike packing. And my biggest, like people who've never done it before, my biggest tip that I say always is load your bike up, because you need to understand how a bike feels loaded. You're probably going to be taking way too much stuff, so take half of it out. It's pretty standard. And then ride to a friend's house and just camp in the garden to start with. Like that's what I did. That's how I started doing it. Is I rode out down into Kent, where I lived in London, and just camped in my mate's garden, because like it was that kind of like, it wasn't so much knowing exactly how to set the tents up and stuff, because I've done that all the time as a kid. It was just, for me, it was knowing that I'm going to be sleeping outside with a very expensive object next to me and making sure I actually slept. And then as the more and more I've done it, you kind of get a bit more experience in knowing what's a good sort of place to camp out at, like what kind of time you should think about setting down and what time you want to get up. It's normally like, for me, it's like up before sunrise always. And it also changes in different countries. Like it's definitely, you know, I think as Spain, you can get away with, you're not supposed to really wild camp anywhere in Spain. They're not strict on it, but they can be funny about it. The police can, but like olive farms, amazing places for wild camping, because you're sheltered by the trees and they're always off the roads. They're amazing for it. And the ground is always soft and flat. So it's a great place for it.
No, the farms on Second City Divide can confirm.
Well, climate change, it could happen in the future.
True. Yeah, but it's such a dark art, isn't it, to picking a wild camp spot. I always get like a bit jittery just before picking it, like as nights, if you're doing like a real, you know, arrive late, leave early. You know, like when night's falling, there's something about night coming, isn't there? Well, normally once it's fallen, you've got your lights on, you're okay. Picking a spot, it just gets better. It just gets easier with time. You just get a sense, don't you, for everything. Is it going to be quiet? Are you going to bump into anyone? If you do bump into anyone, are they going to mind? It's not technically legal in England, is it? It's just like, you won't be told off if you do it in the right place. Is it going to be comfortable? Are you going to stay dry? All that kind of stuff. And it does come together. And then before you know it, you're like, when you're driving along, you're picking out wild camp spots anyway. Like, oh, that'd be a good place. Wouldn't do it there.
Yeah. It's one of those things. It's definitely, the more you do it, the easier it gets, and it is a normalizing it. And as I said, I think if you're very, very new to thinking about doing it, and you are, you know, concerned about going and camping somewhere to start with, go ride to a mate's house, or the other option is like ride to a campsite and actually just camp out at the campsite. And generally speaking, quite a lot of campsites will have somewhere where, if you're worried about your bike, most campsites will probably have somewhere secure where they can put it as well. So there's lots of options. Equally, there, as you said, there's no harm in, if you want to do it bike packing style and you want to do it even lighter weight, just stay in an Airbnb or B&B or hotel, whatever you want. Like, you're still going to be supporting the local businesses around, which is also great. I would always try and find like a small hotel and stuff, because generally if you end up doing that, the breakfasts tend to be amazing, because it's like
top tip.
The couple that's like running it will make the most incredible breakfast. That's what I've found in the past anyway. And also I really do think it's good to not be strict to saying that you have to camp out every night, or you are going to, you know, stay in a hotel or whatever every night, because giving yourself the variety and options is really good as well. Cause like you plan to camp out one night and the weather looks shit. Like there's no harm in then going, cool, I'm going to go get a good night's sleep in a hotel bed, get a shower and not deal with a really terrible night's sleep, getting cold and freezing and just be feeling like shit the next day. At the end of the day, we do these things because we enjoy the adventure and the experience. And sometimes it's completely right to remove the bullshit. Like there's no harm in that. There really is no harm in that. I think some people are like overhyped up about going, oh, I've got to camp out because it's the way it has to be. But I don't want to freeze my tits off, you know?
Yeah, it definitely stay adaptable for those multi-day things. Cause you're exactly right. It's like you can't plan what's going to happen. There's so much variation that could happen over, generally Second City takes sort of 4, 5, 6 days. Mm. And you could easily have a day where you got bogged down by like a couple of punctures or I don't know what, the mechanical, or just your legs weren't that good. But then the next day you could be feeling good and the weather's better and you can make up that distance. Whereas if you've rigidly given yourself a place to camp or whatever, it's always a good idea to have multiple options basically, because you could like flex within those days to make up time to, the running we did of it a couple of years ago, we had awful weather over Crossfell. We wanted to do another sort of 40, 50K after that. But in the end, it was the right decision to, take some bunk beds that were going in Dufton at the bottom, got an early night, got up really early the next morning, and we would made up the time by lunchtime the next day. It was like, stay flexible.
Yeah, exactly.
If you go on the website, there's POIs, points of interest all over the map of like various campsites. So I haven't put any wild camping spots on, because I think that's the bit people have got to look for themselves. But there's like all the YHAs, all the bodies, and like good small accommodation, like you mentioned before.
Nice little cafes on there as well. You put on there.
I could put loads more cafes on there. So especially in Yorkshire, it's like nice cafes everywhere. It's the Scottish borders. You've got a dearth of anything, so you have to carry enough for like the first 2 days.
Yeah.
And then Pennines, there starts to get a few more, and then you've got a day in Yorkshire where it's like the challenge is not to stop in every town.
Yeah. Of course. It's it's a route that's been very much on my radar to do, because it's a great way of seeing more of the United Kingdom. And it's like I did one in Wales, which is Llanlas Cymru. I think that's the correct pronunciation. I'm sorry if it's wrong, anyone. Which is basically from Cardiff heading all the way up to Holyhead. So you go basically cut all across Wales. It's one of the Sustrans routes.
And I did that on road. I've heard of it, but not done it. Is that road or off road?
It's a bit of both, to be honest. It's a bit of road, a bit of off road. I did it on a gravel bike with 42 mil tyres, but they were the Schwalbe G1 all rounds, which is kind of like a gravelly roady tyre. Like it's quite good on light gravel and it rides really well on the road, like low rolling resistance. And I basically goes from. Let me get this right around. Is it Brecon Beacons first or Snowdonia? Goes through that area, both of them, cuts all across, and there's some bits that are road, some bits that are off-road. There's a couple of like quite spicy off-road climbs that, they're spicy. You need to sit down and make sure you're gripping on the road properly. It was like, there's one point where I was like, yep, deflate the tires a little bit. Now I'll be fine. Because it kept slipping and skidding around. But I would definitely, you could do it on a road bike, but the off-road bits would be shit. I'd definitely say a gravel bike or a bike where you can put a higher volume tire on is going to be better, whether it's gravel, cyclocross, mountain bike, whatever. I stopped bang in the middle of the route. And the reason why I stopped, because I was like, this was like, I'd just been, I was trying to get over an injury that I had dealt with for a large proportion of last year. And I was like, I'm going to split it into 2 days, but stop in the middle. Means the first day was a bigger day. The second day was actually slightly shorter, but the first day was bigger in terms of elevation more than anything. And I was going to camp, but the weather was due to be a thunderstorm at night. And I was like, cool, there's an Airbnb another 5K down the road. Just going to stay there for the night. So that's what I did. Stayed in.
Breakfast good.
The breakfast was amazing. The breakfast was amazing. And it was just a woman who'd basically Airbnb'd her spare bedroom out. It was perfect. Yeah. And I bumped into some people doing the Great British Divide at the same time because it kind of encompassed some of the route. Yeah, yeah, which was quite cool.
Huge well stretch of that, yeah. Let's share some of GB Giro and GB Divide, like, do take similar routes to Second City on the way up. Definitely crosses over at points, but yeah, nice.
So then Badger Divide. Let's talk about Badger Divide.
Yeah, so can't take any credit for Badger Divide. It's not our baby. If anything, it was Badger Divide, riding Badger Divide. And like I said, Torino Nice Rally that gave us the idea for Second City Divide. So Badger Divide is set up by a guy called Stu Allen. And his goes from Inverness down to Glasgow, but very similar concept. So a bit shorter, very spectacular because it's Scottish Highlands. I love Second City. I love Second City Divide. I'd get anyone to try and ride it. But if you've got a few less days and you can get up to Inverness on the sleeper train or something, like, there's not really a better 3 days rough stuff riding you can do in the UK, really. And then you finish in Glasgow, you can have beers and jump on the train kind of thing. Or you can start doing Second City Divide from there if you want.
So exactly what I was gonna say.
No coincidence that Second City Divide starts from Glasgow, because we wanted to kind of, we talked to Stu a lot about it when we were putting it together, and James, who put together Torino Nice Rally, you know. It's nice to share kind of information. And then more latterly, there's more routes have appeared. Like, you've seen that old Chalkway
one
that, down there, so he's speaking to the guys to do that. And then Catherine that's putting together her East Devon trail and stuff. They're all like grassroots bikepacking routes, really. Grassroots bikepacking routes. Back to Badger Divide. We actually failed the first time we tried to do that. We were well over ambitious. We tried to do it in November and it was just awful. And we had to bail at like about 2/3 of the way along. And anyway, been back since and conquered it, and then did carry on actually after that down Second City Divide. So that was like seven days out, sort of 2.5 doing Badger Divide, and then the remaining 4.5 doing Second City Divide, which we've kind of unofficially termed the double divide. So if you really want a week or 8-9 days, whatever you want to do, seeing like a best of British bikepacking thing, and all you've got to do is get up to Inverness on the train and know you can get anywhere from Manchester at the end.
Yeah.
I'd like highly recommended. I think as people have, you know, like the last 2 years, people have like explored locally a lot more.
Yeah,
it's been a good time to have like have this thing offered out there that you can give this GPX that you can promise is well researched, is legal. You know, some people want to do their own route planning, which is totally fine. But if they just want to pick up a GPX that they know someone else has worked on, yeah, combination of Badger Divide and Second City Divide or one or the other is a pretty good way to go.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, it's, as you say, if someone's done the hard work for it, like, it makes things much easier in terms of logistics and planning, and you're not going to have any, obviously there can be like, I don't know, a tree falling down or whatever, that these things happen, but you're not going to have.
You know, forestry commissions sometimes change, you know, yeah. It's unofficial. We hold our hands up and say like, we've done the best we can, and to our best of our knowledge, the route is good to go on the day you choose it, but you're looking after yourself. You know, we have no liability in that sense. Send us a message, we'll let you know where some good spots are. Stu's really good at responding. If you want to know information about Badger Divide, he knows it like the back of his hand. And then we'll try and meet you for a coffee in Manchester or beer in Manchester if you make it.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's fantastic. And it's lovely seeing that there's more and more people that are kind of, as you say, like the old Chalkway, et cetera, there's more people who are starting to do these kind of routes and options and just share them out there for people and provide them to people, which is great. Ultimately, the more people that get to explore what's on your doorstep, the better. I think for me personally, the whole last few years, I've ridden more of the UK than I've ever ridden or seen in my life, whether that's in a car or whatever through my old job, whatever. I've seen more of the UK than I ever have before. And I feel like actually we've got a country which is incredible for riding compared to, you know, I mean, yes, like Spain or Belgium or Italy are great, but there's something very like quite heartwarming about doing it in your own country where that you get your own little like, as you say, like things like Eccles cakes and stuff, which are very quintessentially British things, or cherry Bakewell tart or whatever it is, which you're not, yeah, you're not going to find something like that in the Dolomites or in you know, the base of Bond too, you know. So I think it's great that more of these are happening, and it kind of goes in keeping with the fact that, you know, we've spent a long period of time where we haven't been able to travel internationally. And also to the fact that I think a lot of people are getting more conscious about the idea of traveling internationally and not necessarily wanting to fly left, right and center. I know, you know, when I worked in architecture, like I was flying from London to Toronto to Melbourne, basically like once a month. And like, my God, my carbon footprint would have been disgusting. And I don't think I'm ever going to pay it off because I was doing that for like a year, you know. And something I feel quite guilty about still. And I haven't worked in architecture since I was 26, I think.
Yeah. More UK trips for you, Chris.
Yeah. Trains.
I mean, it's definitely so much more, like so much more of the UK I'd still like to explore. Like, I don't even feel like I've not even scratched the surface. Yeah. There's loads of good riding I want to do further up north in Scotland. I've not done that. I've not done the Cape Wrath trail or like some variation on that would be amazing. Yeah, definitely need to get down and ride Devon and Cornwall a bit more. Go and check out Catherine's East Devon route when she properly launches it. I mean, the whole of GB Jura looks amazing as well. I just don't fancy doing it as a wanner, but all that sort of stuff. Yeah, I need to go and do Old Chalk Way because we know the guys that put it together. It's too much to do really, but there's sort of like several years worth of trips to do there and places to see without me getting too worried about needing to go abroad. I'd love to go abroad again. I'd love to go and ride in the Alps or something, go in Brittany. Go and ride around, you know, before you started recording, we were talking about Trobro, Lyon and the Ribonneau, the farm dirt roads in France. Like, I'd love to go there as well. But
yeah.
So it's nice to know that you've got plenty on the doorstep here.
There's one that when I was a kid and I sort of dicked around on crap mountain bikes. Basically, my dad lives in the Isle of Man, which there's incredible cycling there. There's a reason why there's lots of good professional cyclists from the Isle of Man, because the riding is very good, but very, very hard. But then my mum is down in Kent, and a route that I've had penned to do, and I have not done it yet, is the whole Pilgrim's Way, which is like Winchester to Canterbury. And basically there's a section of it which goes basically by my mum's front door. And I think like some of the Old Chalk Way bit encompasses some of that, I think maybe.
It's crossover, mustn't it? Yeah, I'm just looking, like desperately looking on Google now. I don't know the south half as well as I do the north, but yeah, there must be some crossover there.
Yeah, and it's basically the route itself. A friend of mine, actually, a guy called Steve, did part of the route recently, and I was sort of questioning what it was like, if it was good. He's like, yeah, it's completely doable in a larger volume bike packing sort of thing. But I think he did, basically, the Pilgrim's Way was effectively a route where the pilgrims used to go from Winchester Cathedral to Canterbury Cathedral. It basically was that, and it's some of it is... A lot of it's like gravel and sort of across farm fields and trails and stuff, but some of it is definitely quite technical mountain biking. Probably closer to the Winchester side of it than the. So my mum was in a small, very small village called Merryworth. She still is, and which is not spelt Merryworth; it's spelt Mearworth, but that. I think the Pilgrim's Way sort of joins up near where is it? Borough Green, I think, is where it kind of connects up. And that's the bits I used to ride as a kid, effectively. So that's one that I've got it like planned, and I really want to ride that as a full route. And I'm sure I will probably in this year or next year, definitely, just to try it out.
It's very, very satisfying following old ways. So like when we say we've put together Second City Divide, we've strung together existing rights of way in a way that hadn't been done before, but we haven't trailblazed, like haven't physically made new ways anywhere, but lots of it is like sections of old drove road, like bits of the Maiden Way in Cumbria, old corpse roads, just old trade routes, like the old cart tracks over the top of Rooley Moor that I was talking about before and stuff. I always find it really fascinating. Like, essentially, all the ways are already made. It's just some have fallen into disrepair, or some have been like downgraded to bridle way, or some maybe lost totally. Which takes me back to like why we initially enjoyed putting this together, because it's like stitching them together. But there's, I'm looking at the map now because you started talking about the Pilgrim's Way. There's so many old routes through England and through the United Kingdom, isn't there? It's like, it's fascinating.
It is really, and it's lovely that there seems to be this slight resurgence of people wanting to explore them again, whether that is hiking, like trail running, like you've done some quite frankly stupid run recently, or whether it's on a bike.
Started running more because bikepacking's harder now. I've got kids, too much faff factor. I will bikepack again, but yeah, I'm running a bit more at the moment.
What was that run you did recently?
That was well, we've termed it the Peaklander at the moment, but only because we like the name. But it was Manchester to Sheffield. We've got something about going city to city that we really like, because I think it makes things really accessible, because everyone can get the train there and get the train back. So we did across the Peak, Manchester to Sheffield over a couple of days, staying at Steph from Panya CC. He's got a little bunkhouse almost perfectly in the middle of that. We sort of, I mean, I say ran, we ran and walked to the bunkhouse, stayed over. So it was like our first multi-day run. And then just had beer and pizza in Sheffield and got the train back. Pretty good.
It's perfect. I mean, you make it sound so simple, but geez, I can't ever imagine doing that. So I guess there's two things left I want to cover. I'm conscious of time. And one of them is, I'm going to hope that I don't butcher this, Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. Is that right? And
Components that RSPB.
RSPB. Now, genuinely, the reason why I know that is my grandparents used to run an animal charity when they were around. And so we did lots of weird, like, collaboration-y things with charities, one of them being RSPB. It's funny how, my grandparents used to do, my nan used to look after cats, her sister used to do dogs, her other sister used to do, like, kind of everything else in between, which was like tarantulas, tortoises, hawks, goats, llamas, like, and they sort of ran these charities all together, which was really, really quite lovely, actually. And they did something with RSPB as well at some point, because it was, I mean, animal charities, it was all quite well tied up. So first of all, you've created these really lovely enamel pin badges, and 100% of the profit of them goes to the RSPB investigation team. That's
So it's specifically to the investigations team, which is set up to raise awareness and eventually prevent raptor persecution. So me and Christian are both just into birds of prey. Christian's you're more likely to find Christian like with a pair of binoculars around his neck. He's really into birds, but you'll notice the Outdoor Provisions branding features a raptor on it everywhere, and there's references to birds in a lot of the names we use for projects and things like that. So anyway, you know when you're out riding, you know you're on somewhere in the UK and somewhere wild when you see like a buzzard or a kestrel or something hovering, or like takes you by surprise coming out of the forest or something. It was always like part of the outdoor experience for us seeing those. So when we found out around the time of starting the company, we became more aware that this like raptor persecution was going on. I think it's always gone on, but it's essentially cases of shooting, trapping, poisoning, to kill birds of prey in the UK. So in places that we spend our time in, England, Scotland, North Yorkshire is a hotspot for it. The Peak District is a hotspot for it. A lot of cases are linked to like driven, game areas, so like managed areas, not all of them, but it just didn't sit right with us, because they're such a fundamental part of the outdoor experience. To kind of knowingly trap or kill a bird of prey just seemed mad to us. So that's what it's actually our 1% for the planet commitment. You've heard of 1% for the planet.
Yeah.
So that's our 1% for the planet commitment, is to give back to, you can choose your kind of charity that you do it towards. And we do it via the sales of this pin badge, which looks pretty neat as well. It's kind of a nice way to show that you're like against raptor persecution. But they basically each year they'll put together, the RSPB will put together this bird crime report. The first one we saw was something like 2018, and it had pretty bad numbers in it. And then most recently, I think they've got up to the 2020 bird crime report, and it's something like 137 confirmed persecution incidents in the UK alone. That's like 137 beautiful birds of prey. Because it got worse basically in lockdown, when things were less easy to monitor, less easy to trace crimes and things like that. And if you start looking into it, there's some pretty harrowing footage of like hidden cameras and stuff capturing it. But it's just a very hard one to persecute. It's very hard to find the people doing it. So it's something you can look out for, actually, when you're out and about, if you're walking or riding or hiking. You can look out for like suspicious activity. Like, there are legal traps that people can leave out for managing pests. But if something looks suspicious, like large cage traps, or spring traps are very rarely, especially if they're like on posts where birds of prey might land, like that's very suspicious. So like call not 999, but call 101 if you find that kind of thing. Don't touch it. And if you actually find a bird of prey that looks like it's been poisoned or trapped or harmed, then definitely call 101 and let them know.
It's really sad that people do it, because I agree with you. Like, and so often when I've done rides and challenges, like some of the bits I always remember is when like a massive eagle or whatever appears and or flies in front of you or something, and you're always just like, it always takes you back a little bit. You're like, whoa, shit, that's a big.
Yeah, you're like, you see a lot of buzzards. Like, buzzards are like, oh, that's pretty nice, and then you might see something like an osprey if in the right part of Wales or in like that route in the lakes. And then I've seen a sea eagle before. It's like in Scotland on the west coast when I was riding. That's pretty special. And you're like, yeah, how can that possibly be like knowingly hurt or knowingly persecuted? It's just mad. Like, we don't have many really like wild animals. Well, I certainly, that's probably a bit of a wrong statement. We do have wild animals in the UK, but not as many as we used to, I should say, you know.
Yeah. The one that I always think of as well is back in Kent, it was the red kite was the one you used to see a lot of.
So distinct.
Yeah, they were on the cusp of, I think they were on the cusp of being classed as being endangered at one point when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And there was a big like program to reintroduce them and rebreed them, and that's been a massive success now. And it was always really lovely that, you know, go out for rides in Kent, like near where my mum was, and you'd probably see a red kite quite regularly. Same like in Surrey as well, you'd start to see them quite regularly now. There's also like one of the weird things that I talking of birds in London, was that I used to have a little parakeets on my windowsill all the time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they'd escaped from London Zoo years and years ago. And there's like a colony of these green with red head parakeets living in London now, which is strange, very strange.
Bad, yeah. Just to go on your red kites thing. Yeah, they were successfully reintroduced in Yorkshire around, you can go and ride the, it's pretty nice, like gentle off-road trail in Wetherby. It's like a 30-something K trail called the Red Kite Trail, where you can go and you're guaranteed to see lots of spinning red kites with their distinctive forked tails up there. And that's like another successful reintroduction.
It's fantastic that you're offering this back and, you know, selling the pins as well to sort of show support.
It's raise awareness, really. There's not much we can do directly, but it's just like the more awareness we raise, the more pressure we can put on governments to like put policies in place to regulate things like the driven grouse moors and things like that more differently, and to make it more of a crime as well, because it'll make it easier to prosecute, because at the moment it's just very hard to prove.
Yeah,
it's a long way to go, but hope to make a bit of a difference there.
And then the last thing I wanted to cover, which I say cover, is more ask, is you and I discussed briefly about offering a slight discount to any listeners that would like to try any outdoor provisions stuff.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. I haven't set it up yet, but we'll definitely set up a Zero Lemon discount code. We'll do 20% off for We'll do it from, say, we'll do it from a month from whenever this goes live. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'd absolutely love people to give Outdoor Provisions a try. So that's the bars, the nut butter sachets, or the jars that, that you've had recently, Chris. Doesn't come off the Raptor Pin badge, I'm afraid, because it's a charity thing. We don't take discount off that, but it'll work, it'll apply to everything else on there.
But buy the Raptor Pin badge still.
Yes, please do.
And I will put a link in the description below for this podcast and for that. And I'll also put a link in the description for Second City Divide for anyone that will be interested in that. And definitely check out Second City Divide. Have a look into Badge Divide. Maybe consider doing a double divide if you're mad or excited by the idea of it. I personally think the idea of doing the double sounds incredible.
And I'm going to put some pressure on you in the next few weeks to try and commit to that in September. I'd like to see you in Manchester on the 4th of September. That'd be nice.
There we go. And then we will, and also if you can get yourself one of these little pins, they're really lovely pins. I haven't actually ordered one. I will be ordering one.
Put your foot in it there. You've got to have one now. I'm gonna be checking the orders later on.
Exactly. I've kind of shot myself in the foot, but I think it's definitely a very worthy reason for people to purchase them, and they just look nice. I'm a big fan of an enamel pin as well. I always think they look quite smart. And yes, we're going to do this 20% discount code. Zero Lemon is the code.
Yeah, we'll make it Zero Lemon and valid for a month from when this goes live. Yeah.
So get your orders in and try some of this amazing crack that I have in my hand. It's not crack. I keep referring to it as crack because I'd eat it with a spoon out of the tub.
That's why we made it, so you could get it down you in a spoon. Yeah, get a tub for at home or in the van, and then sachets for sticking in your pocket to head out with.
Exactly. And as I say, go for the almond, date and sea salt in a sandwich with cheese and apple.
And a nice sourdough base, yeah.
And a nice sourdough, which you could get from Service Course.
Yeah. Has your podcast got a jingle to start and end it? A little musical jingle, or do you just go straight into the...
It does have a jingle.
Does it? Oh, that's good. I was wondering what... I was going to ask you whether there was like a little intro.
Yeah, there's a little jingle. Which is, I can't even think how it goes now, but it makes me do this a lot when I listen to it.
I can only think of, I can't remember if it was ITV or BBC's Tour de France coverage. Can you picture the music? Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, and then that's all I can think of for jingles.
That was my mate's ringtone for years. Yeah.
Absolute Tour de France fan, yeah.
Yeah, he is. Anyway. Luke, thank you so much for your time and for, discussing some stuff about Outdoor Provisions, a bit about the history of you and Christian setting up the brand, talking about Second City Divide and Badge Divide, and also the RSPB stuff. I think is all amazing things. Thank you for your time and have a lovely day.
Will do. Catch you soon.
Nice one.
Cheers. Bye.